Chapter 11. BLS Resuscitation. Introduction. The principles of basic life support, BLS, were introduced in 1960. Since then, the specific techniques have been reviewed and revised every 5 to 6 years. The updated guidelines are published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. The most recent revision occurred as a result of the 2005 Conference on Cardiopulmonary Resuscitation and Emergency Cardiac Care. The information in this chapter follows the 2005 guidelines and presents a review of BLS. This chapter begins with a definition and general discussion of BLS. The chapter then discusses methods for opening and maintaining an airway, providing artificial ventilation to a person who is not breathing, providing artificial circulation to a person with no pulse, and removing a foreign body airway obstruction. Each of these topics is followed by a review of the changes in technique that are necessary to treat infants and children, a discussion of the methods of preventing the transmission of infectious diseases during cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR, is provided in Chapter 2, Workforce Safety and Wellness. A discussion of the anatomy and physiology of the respiratory and cardiovascular systems can be found in Chapter 5, The Human Body. Elements of BLS. Basic Life Support, BLS, is non-invasive emergency life-saving care that is used to treat medical conditions, including airway obstruction, respiratory arrest, and cardiac arrest. This care focuses on what is often termed the ABCs, airway obstruction, breathing, respiratory arrest, and circulation, cardiac arrest, or severe bleeding. BLS follows a specific sequence for adults and for infants and children. Ideally, only seconds should pass between the time you recognize that a patient needs BLS and the start of treatment. Remember, brain cells die every second that they are deprived of oxygen. Permanent brain damage is possible if the brain is without oxygen for 4 to 6 minutes. After 6 minutes without oxygen, brain damage is likely. If a patient is not breathing well or at all, you may need to open the airway. Very often, this helps the patient to breathe normally again. However, if the patient has no pulse, you must combine artificial ventilation with artificial circulation. If breathing stops before the heart stops, the patient will have enough oxygen in the lungs to stay alive for several minutes. But when cardiac arrest occurs first, the heart and brain stop receiving oxygen immediately. Cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR, is used to establish artificial ventilation and circulation in a patient who is not breathing and has no pulse. The steps for CPR include the following. 1. Opening the airway. 2. Providing artificial respirations by means of rescue breathing, mouth-to-mouth ventilation, mouth-to-nose ventilation, or the use of mechanical devices. 3. Providing chest compressions to circulate blood through the body. The goal of CPR is to restore spontaneous breathing and circulation. However, advanced procedures such as medications and defibrillation are often necessary for this to occur. For CPR to be effective, you must be able to easily identify a patient who is in respiratory and/or cardiac arrest and immediately begin BLS measures. BLS differs from advanced life support, ALS, which involves advanced life-saving procedures such as cardiac monitoring, administration of intravenous fluids and medications, and use of advanced airway adjuncts. However, when done correctly, BLS can maintain life for a short time until ALS measures can be started. In some cases, such as choking, near drowning, or lightning injuries, early BLS measures may be all that is needed to restore a patient's pulse and breathing. Of course, these patients still require transport to the hospital for evaluation. The BLS measures are only as effective as the person who is performing them. Whereas your skills may be very good immediately after training, As time goes on, skills will deteriorate unless you practice them regularly. The system components of CPR. Chain of survival. Few people who experience cardiac arrest in the pre-hospital environment survive unless a rapid sequence of events takes place. The American Heart Association has determined an ideal sequence of events, termed the chain of survival, that, if taken, can improve the chance of successful resuscitation of a patient who has an occurrence of sudden cardiac arrest. The four links in the chain of survival are as follows. Early access. This link requires public education and awareness and the recognition of early warning signs of a cardiac emergency and immediate activation of EMS. Phone first is the first step in the chain so that emergency responders are dispatched to the scene quickly, thus allowing the other links of the chain to occur. In addition, 911 pre-arrival instructions can be given on notification, and the emergency dispatcher can direct the caller to provide CPR as needed. Early CPR. Immediate bystander CPR is essential for successful resuscitation of a person in cardiac arrest. CPR will keep blood, and therefore oxygen, flowing to the vital organs to keep them alive until the other components of the chain are available. The more people trained in CPR in the community, the better the chances of CPR being administered quickly to a person in cardiac arrest. The lay public, as well as emergency responders, should all be trained in CPR. In addition, family members of anyone at risk of sudden cardiac death should be trained and ready to provide CPR if the need ever arises. Early defibrillation. Of all the links, early defibrillation offers the best opportunity to achieve a successful patient outcome. Automated external defibrillators, AEDs, are becoming readily available in most public places. Early advanced care. Advanced cardiac life support includes advanced airway management, manual defibrillation, intravenous IV access, and administration of medications, which together increase the chance of a successful resuscitation. If any one of the links of the chain is absent, the patient is more likely to die. For example, few patients survive cardiac arrest if CPR is not administered within the first few minutes of the arrest. Likewise, if the time from cardiac arrest to defibrillation is more than 10 minutes, the chance of survival is minimal. The best chance of survival occurs when all links in the chain are strong. Automated external defibrillation. Most pre-hospital cardiac arrests occur as the result of a sudden cardiac rhythm disturbance, arrhythmia, such as ventricular fibrillation, VFib, or pulseless ventricular tachycardia, VTAC. The normal heart rhythm is known as normal sinus rhythm. Ventricular fibrillation is the disorganized twitching of the ventricles, resulting in no blood flow and a state of cardiac arrest. Ventricular tachycardia is a rapid contraction of the ventricles that does not allow for normal filling. As mentioned previously, according to the American Heart Association, early defibrillation is the link in the chain of survival that is most likely to improve survival rates. For each minute the patient remains in VFib or pulseless VTAC, there is a 7% to 10% less chance of survival. The automated external defibrillator, AED, should be applied to any cardiac arrest patient older than 1 year as soon as it is available. If indicated, defibrillation should be performed immediately. The simple design of the AED makes it easy for emergency medical responders and laypersons to use with very little training. If you witness the patient's cardiac arrest, begin CPR and apply the AED as soon as it is available. However, if the patient's cardiac arrest was not witnessed by you and your call to arrival interval is greater than 5 minutes, the American Heart Association recommends that you perform 5 cycles, about 2 minutes, of CPR before applying the AED. The rationale for this is that the heart is more likely to respond to defibrillation within the first few minutes of the onset of ventricular fibrillation. If the arrest interval is prolonged, however, the chance of successful defibrillation is improved after a brief period of CPR. If you're in a facility with AED units available on site, you should perform CPR immediately and then use the AED as soon as it is available. Chapter 14, Cardiovascular Emergencies, covers AED use in detail. AED usage in children. Cardiac rhythms that require defibrillation can be the cause of sudden cardiac arrest or may develop during resuscitation attempts. According to the American Heart Association, AEDs can safely be used in children older than 1 year of age. When using an AED on a child between 1 and 8 years of age, you should use pediatric-sized pads and a dose attenuating system, energy reducer. However, if these are not available, an adult AED should be used. The AED is not indicated for use in infants younger than 1 year of age. During CPR, the AED should be applied to children older than 1 year of age after the first 5 cycles of CPR have been completed. Cardiac arrest in children is usually the result of respiratory failure. Therefore, oxygenation and ventilation are vitally important. After the first 5 cycles of CPR, the AED should be used to deliver shocks in the same manner as with an adult patient. Special AED situations. Safety to you, others at the scene, and the patient should always be a priority. As such, it is important to keep some factors in mind when using an AED unit. Pacemaker. You may encounter a patient who has an implanted defibrillator or pacemaker that delivers shocks directly to the heart if necessary. These patients usually have a high risk of sudden cardiac arrest. It is easy to recognize these devices because they create a hard lump beneath the skin in the chest near the heart. If the electrical pads are placed directly over the device, it may block any shock delivered by the AED unit. Therefore, if you identify an implanted defibrillator or pacemaker, you should place the AED electrodes at least 1 inch to the side of the device. Occasionally, the implanted device will deliver shocks to the patient. If you observe the patient's muscles twitching as if just shocked, wait 30 to 60 seconds before delivering a shock from the AED. Wet patients. Water is a good conductor of electricity. Therefore, the AED unit should not be used in water. If the patient's chest is covered with water, the electrical current may move across the skin rather than between the pads to the patient's heart. If the patient is in water, pull him or her out of the water and quickly dry the skin before attaching the electrodes. If the patient is in a small puddle of water or in the snow, the AED can be used, but the patient's chest should be dry. Transdermal medication patches. You may encounter a patient who is receiving medication through a transdermal medication patch. The medication is absorbed through the skin. The patch could block the electrical current to the heart and may cause a burn to the skin. To prevent this, remove the patch and wipe the skin to remove the medication residue prior to attaching the AED pads. Assessing the need for BLS. As always, begin by surveying the scene. Is the scene safe? How many patients are there? What is your initial impression of the patients? Are there bystanders who may have additional information? What is the mechanism of injury or nature of illness? Do you suspect trauma? If you were dispatched to the scene, does the dispatch information match what you are seeing? Because of the urgent need to start CPR in a pulseless, non-breathing patient, you must complete a primary assessment as soon as possible, evaluating the patient's ABCs. The first step is determining unresponsiveness. Clearly, a patient who is conscious does not need CPR. A person who is unresponsive may or may not need CPR. To determine unresponsiveness, gently tap the patient on the shoulder and shout, "Are you okay?" If the patient does not respond to verbal or physical stimulation, he or she is unconscious. If you suspect the presence of a cervical spine injury, you must take steps to protect the spinal cord from further injury as you perform CPR. If there is even a remote possibility of this type of injury, you should begin taking appropriate precautions during the primary assessment. The basic principles of BLS are the same for infants, children, and adults. For the purposes of BLS, anyone younger than 1 year is considered an infant. A child is between 1 year of age and the onset of puberty, 12 to 14 years of age. Adulthood is from the onset of puberty and older. Children vary in size. Some small children may best be treated as infants, some large children as adults. There are two basic differences in providing CPR for infants, children, and adults. The first is that the emergencies in which infants and children require CPR usually have different underlying causes. The second is that there are anatomic differences in adults, children, and infants, such as smaller airways in infants and children than in adults. Although cardiac arrest in adults usually occurs before respiratory arrest, the reverse is true in infants and children. In most cases, cardiac arrest in children results from respiratory arrest. If untreated, respiratory arrest will quickly lead to cardiac arrest and death. Respiratory arrest in infants and children has a variety of causes, including aspiration of foreign bodies into the airway, such as parts of hot dogs, peanuts, candy, or small toys, airway infections such as croup and epiglottitis, near-drowning incidents or electrocution, and sudden infant death syndrome, also known as SIDS. Positioning the patient. The next step in providing CPR is to position the patient to ensure that the airway is open. For CPR to be effective, the patient must be lying supine on a firm surface with enough clear space around the patient for two rescuers to perform CPR. If the patient is crumpled up or lying face down, you will need to reposition him or her. The few seconds that you spend to position the patient properly will greatly improve the delivery and effectiveness of CPR. Follow the steps in Skill Drill 11-1 to reposition an unconscious adult for airway management. Skill Drill 11-1. 1. Kneel beside the patient. You and your partner must be far enough away so that the patient, when rolled toward you, does not come to rest in your lap. 2. Place your hands on either side of the patient's head and neck to protect the cervical spine if you suspect spinal injury. Your partner places his or her hands on the patient's distant shoulder and hip. 3. Your partner turns the patient toward him or her by pulling on the patient's distant shoulder and hip. Control the head and neck so that they move as a unit with the rest of the torso. This single motion will allow the head, neck, and back to stay in the same vertical plane and will minimize aggravation of any spinal injury. 4. Place the patient in a supine position with the legs straight and both arms at the sides. If possible, log roll the patient onto a long backboard as you are positioning him or her for CPR. This device will provide support during transport and emergency care. Once the patient is properly positioned, you can easily assess airway, breathing, circulation, and the need for defibrillation and start CPR if necessary. Assessing ABCs. Opening the airway in adults. The next step in BLS is to open the patient's airway. There are two techniques for opening the airway in adults: the head tilt chin lift maneuver and the jaw thrust maneuver. Head tilt chin lift maneuver. Opening the airway to relieve an obstruction caused by relaxation of the tongue can often be accomplished quickly and easily with the head tilt chin lift maneuver. In patients who have not sustained trauma, this simple maneuver is sometimes all that is required for the patient to resume breathing. If the patient has any foreign material or vomitus in the mouth, you should quickly remove it through suctioning. You should perform the head tilt chin lift maneuver in an adult in the following way. 1. Make sure the patient is supine. Kneel close beside the patient. 2. Place one hand on the patient's forehead and apply firm backward pressure with your palm to tilt the patient's head back. This extension of the neck will move the tongue forward, away from the back of the throat, and will clear the airway if the tongue is blocking it. 3. Place the tips of the index and middle fingers of your other hand under the lower jaw near the bony part of the chin. Do not compress the soft tissue under the chin because this will block the airway. 4. Lift the chin upward, bringing the entire lower jaw with it, helping to tilt the head back. Do not use your thumb to lift the chin. Lift so that the teeth are nearly brought together, but avoid closing the mouth completely. The chin lift has the added advantage of holding loose dentures in place, making obstruction by the lips less likely. Performing ventilation is much easier when dentures are in place. However, dentures that do not stay in place should be removed. Partial dentures, plates, may come loose as a result of an accident or as you are providing care, so check these periodically. Jaw thrust maneuver. The head tilt chin lift maneuver is effective for opening the airway in most patients. However, in patients with suspected spinal injury, you want to minimize movement of the patient's neck. For these patients, perform a jaw thrust maneuver. To perform a jaw thrust maneuver, place your fingers behind the angles of the patient's lower jaw and then move the jaw upward. Use your thumbs to help position the lower jaw. Keep the head in a neutral position as you move the jaw upward and open the mouth. If the patient's mouth remains closed, you can use your thumbs to pull the patient's lower lip down to allow breathing. If the jaw thrust maneuver fails to open the airway, the head tilt chin lift should be used to open the airway. An open airway is a primary goal when managing trauma patients, and it must be attained to improve the patient's chances of survival. Perform the jaw thrust maneuver as follows. 1. Kneel above the patient's head. Place your fingers behind the angle of the patient's lower jaw on both sides and forcefully move the jaw upward without manipulating the patient's neck. Use your thumbs to help position the lower jaw. 2. Use your thumbs to open the mouth to allow breathing. 3. The nose can be sealed with your cheek when providing rescue breathing using the jaw thrust maneuver. Check for breathing. After you open the airway, check for breathing by placing your ear just above the patient's nose and mouth. Listen for sounds of breathing. Turn your head so that you can watch for movement of the patient's chest and abdomen. This is called the look, listen, and feel technique. This evaluation should take at least 5 seconds, but no more than 10 seconds. If you see the chest and abdomen rise and fall, and, more important, if you feel and hear air move during exhalation, the patient is breathing. If you do not feel any air movement as you look, listen, and feel, you must begin artificial ventilation. A lack of oxygen, combined with too much carbon dioxide in the blood, is lethal. To correct this condition, you must provide slow, deliberate ventilations that last 1 second. This gentle, slow method of ventilating the patient prevents air from being forced into the stomach. Recovery position. If the patient is breathing on his or her own and has no signs of trauma, you should place him or her in the recovery position. This positioning helps to maintain a clear airway in a patient with a decreased level of consciousness who has not had traumatic injuries and is breathing adequately on his or her own. It also allows vomitus to drain from the mouth. Roll the patient onto his or her side so that the head, shoulders, and torso move as a unit without twisting. Then place the patient's hand under his or her cheek. Never place a patient who has a suspected head or spinal injury in the recovery position because maintenance of spinal alignment in this position is not possible and further spinal cord injury could result. provide artificial ventilations. Ventilations can be given by one or two EMTs, by EMRs, or by trained bystanders. Ambient air contains 21% oxygen, and the body uses 5%. Therefore, by exhaling air into the patient, you are delivering 16% oxygen, which, along with efforts to support the circulation, is sufficient to maintain the patient's life. A barrier device should be used when you are administering ventilations. In the pre-hospital environment, ventilations are routinely provided using barrier devices, such as a pocket mask or a bag mask device. These devices feature a plastic barrier that covers the patient's mouth and nose and a one-way valve to prevent exposure to secretions and exhaled contaminants. Such devices also provide good infection control. If a mask is not available, a face shield or some other type of physical barrier should be used. Providing ventilations without a barrier device should be performed only in extreme conditions. When available, the EMT should use devices that supply supplemental oxygen when possible. Devices that have an oxygen reservoir will provide a higher percentage of oxygen to the patient. Regardless of whether you are ventilating the patient with or without supplemental oxygen, you should observe the chest for adequate rise to assess the effectiveness of your ventilations. Ventilations need to be delivered at a rate and depth that is not excessive, so as to not cause increased intrathoracic pressure. Increased intrathoracic pressure impedes venous return to the right side of the heart, thus decreasing the effectiveness of CPR because overall blood flow is reduced, resulting in the heart and brain receiving decreased amounts of oxygen. You should perform rescue breathing in an adult with a simple barrier device in the following manner. 1. Open the airway with the head tilt chin lift maneuver, non-trauma patient. 2. Press on the forehead to maintain the backward tilt of the head. Pinch the patient's nostrils together with your thumb and index finger. 3. Depress the lower lip with the thumb of the hand that is lifting the chin. This will help to keep the patient's mouth open. 4. Open the patient's mouth widely and place the barrier device over the patient's mouth and nose. 5. Take a deep breath. Then make a tight seal with your mouth around the barrier device. Give 2 slow rescue breaths, each lasting 1 second. 6. Remove your mouth and allow the patient to exhale passively. Turn your head slightly to watch for movement of the patient's chest. When you are using the jaw thrust maneuver to open the airway in suspected neck or spine injury, positioning yourself at the patient's head will facilitate simultaneous cervical spine stabilization and adequate ventilation. Keep the patient's mouth open with both thumbs and seal the nose by placing your cheek against the patient's nostrils. Note that this maneuver is somewhat difficult. Practicing with a mannequin will help you gain familiarity with this technique. Stoma ventilation. Patients who have undergone surgical removal of the larynx often have a permanent tracheal stoma at the midline in the neck. A stoma at this site serves as an opening that connects the trachea directly to the skin of the neck. Because the stoma is positioned at the midline of the neck, this is the only opening that will move air into the patient's lungs. As such, you should ignore any other openings, including the mouth or nose. Patients with a stoma should be ventilated with a bag mask device or a pocket mask device directly over the stoma. Not all stomas are disconnected from the nose and mouth. If air leakage through the nose and mouth interferes with ventilation through the stoma, cover the nose and mouth with your hand. Use a pediatric or infant mask to ventilate through the stoma. Gastric distension. Artificial ventilation may result in the stomach becoming filled with air, a condition called gastric distension. Although this condition occurs more easily in children, it also happens frequently in adults. Gastric distension is likely to occur if you ventilate too fast, if you give too much air, or if the patient's airway is not opened adequately. Therefore, it is important for you to give slow, gentle breaths. Such breaths are also more effective in ventilating the lungs. Serious inflation of the stomach is dangerous because it can cause the patient to vomit during CPR. It can also reduce lung volume by moving the diaphragm higher. If massive gastric distension interferes with adequate ventilation, you should contact medical control. Check the airway again and reposition the patient. Watch for rise and fall of the chest and avoid giving forceful breaths. Medical control may order you to turn the patient on his or her side and provide gentle manual pressure to the abdomen to expel air from the stomach. Have suction readily available and be prepared for copious amounts of vomitus. If gastric distension interferes with your ability to perform adequate artificial ventilations, it must be managed. Check for a pulse. Once you have arrived at the scene and determined that the patient is unresponsive and not breathing, position the patient and administer 2 rescue breaths. After performing these actions, assess the patient's circulation. Cardiac arrest is determined by the absence of a palpable pulse at the carotid artery. Feel for the carotid artery by locating the larynx at the front of the neck and then sliding 2 fingers toward one side. The pulse is felt in the groove between the larynx and the sternocleidomastoid muscle, with the pulp of the index and middle fingers held side by side. Light pressure is sufficient to palpate the pulse. Check the pulse for at least 5 seconds, but no longer than 10 seconds. If a pulse cannot be felt, begin CPR. If the patient has a pulse but is not breathing, provide rescue breaths as described previously at a rate of 10 to 12 breaths per minute, or 1 every 5 seconds for an adult and 1 every 3 seconds for an infant or child. Provide external chest compressions. Chest compressions are administered by applying rhythmic pressure and relaxation to the lower half of the sternum. The heart is located slightly to the left of the middle of the chest, between the sternum and the spine. Compressions squeeze the heart, thereby acting as a pump to circulate blood. When artificial ventilations are provided, the blood that is circulated through the lungs by chest compressions is likely to receive adequate oxygen to maintain tissue perfusion. However, even when external chest compressions are performed as proficiently as possible, they circulate only 1/3 of the blood that is normally pumped by the heart, so it is very important to perform the compressions properly. Prior to administering external chest compressions, it is important to place the patient on a firm, flat surface in a supine position. The patient's head should not be elevated at a level above the heart because this will further reduce blood flow to the brain. The surface can be the ground, the floor, or a backboard on a stretcher. You cannot adequately perform chest compressions on a bed. Therefore, a patient who is in bed should be moved to the floor or have a board placed under the back. Proper hand position. Correct hand position for chest compressions is accomplished by placing the heel of one hand on the sternum, center of the chest, between the patient's nipples, lower half of the sternum. Follow the steps in Skill Drill 11-2. Skill Drill 11-2. 1. Place the heel of one hand on the sternum between the nipples. 2. Place the heel of your other hand over the first hand. 3. With your arms straight, lock your elbows and position your shoulders directly over your hands. Your technique may be improved or made more comfortable if you interlock the fingers of your lower hand with the fingers of your upper hand. Either way, your fingers should be kept off the patient's chest. 4. Depress the sternum 1.5 inches to 2 inches using direct downward movement and then rising gently upward. It is important that you allow the chest to return to its normal position. Proper compression technique. Complications from chest compressions are rare, but can include fractured ribs, a lacerated liver, and a fractured sternum. Although these injuries cannot be entirely avoided, you can minimize the chance that they will occur if you use good, smooth technique and proper hand placement. Proper compressions begin by locking your elbows with your arms straight and positioning your shoulders directly over your hand so that the thrust of each compression is straight down on the sternum. For an adult, depress the sternum 1 1/2 inches to 2 inches, avoiding a rocking motion and rising gently upward. This motion allows pressure to be delivered vertically down from your shoulders. Vertical downward pressure produces a compression that must be followed immediately by an equal period of relaxation. The ratio of time devoted to compression versus relaxation should be 1:1. The actual motions must be smooth, rhythmic, and uninterrupted. Short, slow, jabbing compressions with little recoil are not effective in producing artificial blood flow. Frequent interruptions in compressions also result in ineffective blood movement. Do not remove the heel of your hand from the patient's chest during relaxation, but make sure that you completely release pressure on the sternum so that it can return to its normal resting position between compressions. One Rescuer Adult CPR. When you are providing CPR alone, you must give both artificial ventilations and chest compressions in a ratio of compressions to ventilations of 30:2. To perform One Rescuer Adult CPR, follow the steps in Skill Drill 11-3. Skill Drill 11-3. 1. Determine unresponsiveness and then call for additional help. 2. Position the patient properly, supine, and open the airway according to suspicion of spinal injury. 3. Determine breathlessness by using the look, listen, and feel technique. If the patient is unconscious but breathing adequately, place him or her in the recovery position to maintain the open airway. 4. If the patient is not breathing, begin rescue breathing by delivering 2 breaths for 1 second each. 5. Determine pulselessness by checking the carotid pulse. If there is no pulse and you have an AED, apply it now. 6. If pulseless and there is no AED, begin compressions. Place your hands in the proper position for delivering external chest compressions as described previously. 7. Give 30 compressions at a rate of about 100 per minute for an adult. Each set of 30 compressions should take about 20 seconds. By using a rhythmic motion, apply pressure vertically from your shoulders down through both arms to depress the sternum 1 1/2 inches to 2 inches for an adult. Then rise up gently and fully. Count the compressions aloud. 8. Open the airway and then give 2 ventilations, each lasting 1 second. 9. Relocate the proper position and begin another cycle of chest compressions. Perform 5 cycles of compressions and ventilations. 10. After 5 cycles of compressions and ventilations, stop CPR and check for the return of a carotid pulse. If there is no change, resume CPR. If the patient has a pulse, check for breathing at a rate of 1 breath every 5 seconds for an adult. If the patient is not breathing or is breathing inadequately, provide rescue breathing. If the patient has a pulse, is breathing adequately but remains unresponsive, place the patient in the recovery position and closely monitor the patient's condition. 11. If a spontaneous pulse has not returned after 5 cycles, consider immediate transport to the hospital while continuing CPR. If available, meet ALS en route. 2 Rescuer Adult CPR. You and your team should be able to perform 1 Rescuer and 2 Rescuer CPR with ease. 2 Rescuer CPR is always preferable because it is less tiring and facilitates effective chest compressions. Once 1 Rescuer CPR is in progress, a 2nd Rescuer can be added very easily. Prior to assisting with CPR, the 2nd Rescuer should set up airway adjuncts, including a bag mask device and suction, and should insert an oral airway. If not already done, the 2nd Rescuer should also apply the AED. If CPR is in progress, the second rescuer should enter the procedure after a cycle of 30 compressions and 2 ventilations. To perform adult 2-rescuer CPR, follow the steps in Skill Drill 11-4. Skill Drill 11-4. 1. While moving to the patient's head, determine unresponsiveness as your partner moves to the patient's side to be ready to deliver chest compressions. 2. Position the patient to open the airway. 3. Check for breathing by using the look, listen, and feel technique. If the patient is unconscious but breathing adequately, place him or her in the recovery position and maintain the open airway. 4. If the patient is not breathing, begin rescue breathing by delivering 2 breaths for 1 second each. 5. Determine pulselessness by checking the carotid pulse. If the patient has no pulse and an AED is available, apply it now. 6. If no AED is available, begin chest compressions at a ratio of 30 to 2. Once the airway is secured, intubated, rescuers should no longer deliver cycles of CPR. Chest compressions should be delivered continuously, 100 per minute, while rescue breaths are delivered every 6 to 8 seconds at a rate of 8 to 10 breaths per minute. 7. After 2 minutes of CPR, the rescuer providing the compressions should be replaced. If there is a third rescuer available, have the rescuer position him or herself at the chest opposite the compressor. Make the switch when both rescuers are ready, keeping the switch time to as little as possible, 5 to 10 seconds. If only 2 rescuers are available, make the switch mid-cycle during compressions. 8. Check for a pulse every few minutes. Pulse checks should last no more than 10 seconds. If there is no pulse, continue CPR beginning with compressions. If the patient has a pulse, check for breathing. If the patient is not breathing, provide ventilations. If the patient has a pulse and is breathing but remains unresponsive, place the patient in the recovery position and closely monitor the patient's condition. Switching positions. Switching rescuers during CPR is beneficial to the quality of CPR administered to the patient. After 2 minutes of CPR, the rescuer providing compressions will begin to tire and compression quality will begin to decline. It is therefore recommended to switch the rescuer doing compressions every 2 minutes. If there are only 2 rescuers, the rescuers will switch positions. If additional rescuers are available, rotating the rescuer providing compressions every 2 minutes is essential. During switches, every effort should be made to minimize the time that no compressions are being administered. There should be no more than 10 seconds of a break in between the compression cycle. The switch between the 2 rescuers can be easily accomplished. Rescuer 1 should finish the cycle of 30 compressions, while rescuer 2 moves to the opposite side of the chest and moves into position to begin compressions. Rescuer 1 should deliver 2 rescue breaths, and then rescuer 2 should take over compressions by administering 30 chest compressions. Rescuer 1 will then deliver 2 ventilations, and the CPR cycles will continue as needed until the next 2-minute mark is reached, at which time the process will be repeated. Devices to assist circulation. The effectiveness of CPR is dependent on the amount of blood circulated throughout the body as the result of chest compressions. Even under ideal conditions, however, manual chest compressions cannot equate to normal cardiac output. In addition, factors such as rescuer fatigue or inaccurate depth or rate of compressions can further impede the resuscitation process. Several mechanical devices are now available to assist emergency responders in delivering improved circulatory efforts when providing CPR. Although improved patient outcomes have not yet been documented, these devices may be considered for use as an adjunct to CPR when used by properly trained personnel for patients in cardiac arrest in the pre-hospital or in-hospital setting. Impedance Threshold Device. An impedance threshold device, ITD, is a valve device placed between the endotracheal tube and a bag mask device. It is designed to limit the air entering the lungs during the recoil phase between chest compressions. This results in negative intrathoracic pressure that draws more blood toward the heart, ultimately resulting in improved cardiac filling and circulation during each chest compression. For use in a non-intubated patient, studies suggest that the ITD could be used with a face mask. However, a tight seal is essential to achieve the desired effect. Although increased survival rates have not been proven, the use of ITDs can improve the effectiveness of CPR when used by trained rescuers. Mechanical piston device. A mechanical piston device is a device that depresses the sternum via a compressed gas-powered plunger mounted on the backboard. The patient is positioned supine on the backboard, with the piston positioned on top of the patient, with the plunger centered over the patient's thorax in the same manner as with manual chest compressions. The device is then secured to the backboard. The device allows rescuers to configure the depth and rate of compressions, resulting in uniform delivery. This frees the rescuer to complete other tasks and eliminates rescuer fatigue that results from continuous delivery of manual chest compressions. Load-distributing band CPR, or vest CPR. The load-distributing band, LDB, is a circumferential chest compression device composed of a constricting band and backboard. The device is either electrically or pneumatically driven to compress the heart by putting inward pressure on the thorax. As with the mechanical piston device, use of the device frees the rescuer to complete other tasks. The device is lighter than the mechanical piston device and is easier to apply. The end result is improved hemodynamics in the patient when used by properly trained emergency responders. Infant and child CPR. As previously stated, the reasons for cardiopulmonary arrest differ in children and adults. In adults, cardiac arrest is usually the result of an abnormal cardiac rhythm, which is usually caused by underlying cardiac disease. Because most children have healthy hearts, sudden cardiac arrest is rare. More commonly, children experience cardiopulmonary arrest as a result of respiratory or circulatory failure from illness or injury. For this reason, the airway and breathing are the focus of pediatric basic life support, BLS. Respiratory problems leading to cardiopulmonary arrest in children can have a number of different causes, including injury, both blunt and penetrating, infections of the respiratory tract or another organ system, a foreign body in the airway, near drowning, electrocution, poisoning or drug overdose, sudden infant death syndrome. Pediatric BLS can be divided into four steps. 1. Determining responsiveness. 2. Airway. 3. Breathing. 4. Circulation. Determining responsiveness. Never shake a child to determine whether he or she is responsive, especially if there is the possibility of a neck or back injury. Instead, gently tap the child on the shoulder and speak loudly. If a child is responsive but struggling to breathe, allow him or her to remain in whatever position is most comfortable. If you find an unresponsive, apneic, and pulseless child while you are alone and not on duty, perform CPR for approximately 2 minutes, then stop to call the EMS system. Why not call right away as you would with an adult? In children, cardiopulmonary arrest is most often the result of respiratory failure, not a primary cardiac event. Therefore, they will require immediate restoration of oxygenation, ventilation, and circulation, which can be accomplished by immediately performing 5 cycles, about 2 minutes, of CPR before activating the EMS system.
airway. Children, infants, and toddlers often put toys and other objects, as well as food, in their mouths. Therefore, foreign body obstruction of the upper airway is common. You must make sure that the upper airway is open when managing pediatric respiratory emergencies or cardiopulmonary arrest. If the child is unconscious and lying in a supine position, the airway may become obstructed when the tongue and throat muscles relax and the tongue falls backward. If the child is unconscious but breathing, place him or her in the recovery position, in which the upper leg is flexed and bent forward for stabilization, and the head is positioned to allow drainage of saliva or vomitus. Do not use this position if you suspect a spinal injury unless you can secure the child to a backboard that can be tilted to the side. Do not attempt to open the airway at all if the child is conscious and breathing, but in a labored fashion. Instead, provide immediate transport to the nearest hospital. There are two common techniques for manually opening the airway in a child who is unconscious and not breathing: the head tilt chin lift maneuver and the jaw thrust maneuver. The jaw thrust maneuver is safer to use if there is a possibility of spinal injury. Remember, however, that if the jaw thrust maneuver does not adequately open the child's airway, carefully perform the head tilt chin lift maneuver. Head tilt chin lift maneuver. Perform this technique in a child in the following manner. 1. Place one hand on the child's forehead and tilt the head back gently with the neck slightly extended. 2. Place the fingers, not the thumb, of your other hand under the child's chin and lift the jaw upward and outward. Do not close the mouth or push under the chin. Either move may obstruct rather than open the airway. 3. Remove any visible foreign body or vomitus. Jaw thrust maneuver. Perform this maneuver in a child in the following manner. 1. Place two or three fingers under each side of the angle of the lower jaw. Lift the jaw upward and outward. 2. If the jaw thrust alone does not open the airway and cervical spine injury is not a consideration, tilt the head slightly. If cervical spine injury is suspected, use a second rescuer to immobilize the cervical spine. Remember that the head of an infant or young child is disproportionately large in comparison to the chest and shoulders. As a result, when a child is lying flat on his or her back, especially on a backboard, the head will bend forward, hyperflexion, onto the upper chest. This position can partially or completely obstruct the upper airway. To avoid this possibility, place a wedge of padding under the child's upper chest and shoulders, torso. Breathing. Once the airway is open, take at least 5 seconds, but no more than 10 seconds, to determine if the child is breathing spontaneously, using the look, listen, and feel technique. Look for rise and fall of the chest or abdomen. Listen for exhalation of breath. Feel for exhaled airflow at the mouth. If an infant or small child is breathing, provide immediate transport. Again, a child who is in respiratory distress should be allowed to stay in whatever position is most comfortable. Larger children who are unconscious and breathing with difficulty should be kept in the recovery position if possible. If an infant or child is not breathing, provide rescue breathing while keeping the airway open. If you are using mouth-to-mouth resuscitation with an infant, place your mouth over the infant's mouth and nose to create a seal. If you are using a bag mask device to assist ventilations in an infant, use the proper sized mask and the technique described earlier. When two rescuers are available, use your thumb and index finger to apply pressure to the cricoid cartilage just below the larynx, the Selleck maneuver. This will decrease the risk of gastric distension and aspiration of vomitus by pushing the larynx back to compress and close off the esophagus. In a child with tracheostomy, breathing tubes in the neck, remove the mask from the bag mask device and connect it directly to the tracheostomy tube to ventilate the child. If a bag mask device is unavailable, a mask, barrier device, or your mouth over the tracheostomy site can be used. Place your hand firmly over the child's mouth and nose to prevent the artificial breaths from leaking out of the upper airway. Circulation. Once you have opened the airway and provided two rescue breaths, you must then assess the child's circulation. Check for pulses in the carotid or femoral arteries in children and the brachial artery in infants. Locate the carotid artery by placing one or two fingers over the groove between the cricoid cartilage and the neck muscles. The femoral artery can be felt in the crease between the upper leg and groin. Locate the brachial artery by placing two or three fingers on the inside of an infant's upper arm between the elbow and the shoulder. Take at least 5 seconds, but no more than 10 seconds, to assess for a pulse. If the infant or child is not breathing, the pulse is often too slow, less than 60 beats per minute, or absent altogether. Therefore, CPR will be required. For chest compressions to be effective, the patient should be placed on a firm, flat surface with the head at the same level of the body. If you need to carry an infant while providing CPR, your forearm and hand can serve as the flat surface. Follow these steps to perform infant chest compressions. Skill Drill 11.5. 1. Place the infant on a firm surface, using one hand to keep the head in an open airway position. You can also use a pad or wedge under the shoulders and upper body to keep the head from tilting forward. 2. Imagine a line drawn between the nipples. Place two fingers in the middle of the sternum, about 1/2 inch below the level of the imaginary line, one finger width. 3. Using two fingers, compress the sternum about 1/3 to 1/2 the depth of the chest. Compress the chest at a rate of 100 per minute. 4. After each compression, allow the sternum to return briefly to its normal position. Allow equal time for compression and relaxation of the chest. Do not remove your fingers from the sternum and avoid jerky movements. Coordinate rapid compressions and ventilations in a 30-to-2 ratio, making sure the infant's chest fully recoils in between compressions and that the chest visibly rises with each ventilation. You will find this easier to do if you use your free hand to keep the head in the open airway position. If the chest does not rise or rises only a little, use a chin lift to open the airway. Reassess the infant for signs of spontaneous breathing or pulses after 5 cycles, about 2 minutes of CPR. Skill Drill 11.6 shows the steps for performing CPR in children between 1 year of age and the onset of puberty. Skill Drill 11.6. 1. Place the child on a firm surface and use one hand to maintain the head in a tilted back position to open the airway. Deliver 2 rescue breaths. 2. Place the heel of 1 or 2 hands in the center of the chest in between the nipples. Avoid compression over the lower tip of the sternum, which is called the xiphoid process. 3. Compress the chest about 1/3 to 1/2 the depth of the chest at a rate of 100 per minute. With pauses for ventilation, the actual number of compressions delivered will be about 80 per minute. In between compressions, allow the chest to fully recoil. Compression and relaxation time should be the same duration. Use smooth movements. Hold your fingers off the child's ribs and keep the heel of your hands on the sternum. 4. Coordinate rapid compressions and ventilations in a 30-to-2 ratio for one rescuer and 15-to-2 for 2 rescuers, making sure the chest rises with each ventilation. At the end of each cycle, pause for 2 ventilations. 5. After 5 cycles, about 2 minutes, assess for breathing and pulses. If there is no pulse and you have an AED, apply it now. 6. If the child resumes effective breathing, place him or her in a position that allows for frequent reassessment of the airway and vital signs during transport. Remember, if the child is past the onset of puberty, use the adult CPR sequence, including the use of the AED. Interrupting CPR. CPR is an important holding action that provides minimal circulation and ventilation until the patient can receive definitive care in the form of defibrillation or further care at the hospital. No matter how well CPR is performed, however, it is rarely enough to save a patient's life. If ALS is not available at the scene, you must provide transport based on your local protocols, continuing CPR on the way. En route to the hospital, you should consider requesting a rendezvous with ALS personnel if available. This will provide ALS care to the patient earlier, improving his or her chance for survival. Note, however, that not all EMS systems have ALS support available to them, especially in rural settings. Try not to interrupt CPR for more than a few seconds, except when it is absolutely necessary. For example, if you have to move a patient up or downstairs, you should continue CPR until you arrive at the head or foot of the stairs. Interrupt CPR at an agreed-on signal and move quickly to the next level where you can resume CPR. Do not move the patient until all transport arrangements are made so that your interruptions of CPR can be kept to a minimum. When not to start BLS. As an EMT, it is your responsibility to start CPR in virtually all patients who are in cardiac arrest. There are only two general exceptions to the rule. First, you should not start CPR if the patient has obvious signs of death. Obvious signs of death include an absence of a pulse and breathing, along with any one of the following findings: rigor mortis, or stiffening of the body after death; dependent lividity, liver mortis, a discoloration of the skin caused by pooling of blood; putrefaction or decomposition of the body; evidence of non-survivable injury, such as decapitation, dismemberment, or burned beyond recognition. Rigor mortis and dependent lividity develop after a patient has been dead for a long period. Second, you should not start CPR if the patient and his or her physician have previously agreed on do not resuscitate, DNR orders, or no CPR orders. This may apply only to situations in which the patient is known to be in the terminal stage of an incurable disease. In this situation, CPR serves only to prolong the patient's death. However, this can be a complicated issue. Advanced directives, such as living wills, may express the patient's wishes. However, these documents may not be readily producible by the patient's family or caregiver. In such cases, the safest course is to assume that an emergency exists and begin CPR under the rule of implied consent and contact medical control for further guidance. Conversely, if a valid DNR document or living will is produced, resuscitative efforts may be withheld. Learn your local protocols and the standards in your system for treating terminally ill patients. Some EMS systems have computer notes on patients who are pre-registered with the system. These notes usually specify the amount and extent of treatment that is desired. Other states have specific EMS DNR forms that allow EMS providers to withhold care when the patient, family, and physician have agreed in advance that such a course is most appropriate. It is essential that you understand your local protocols and are aware of the specific restrictions these advanced directives imply. In all other cases, you should begin CPR on anyone who is in cardiac arrest. It is usually impossible to know how long the patient has been without oxygen to the brain and vital organs. Factors such as air temperature and the basic health of the patient's tissues and organs can affect their ability to survive. Therefore, most legal advisors recommend that, when in doubt, always give too much care rather than too little care. You should always start CPR if any doubt exists. When to stop BLS. You are not responsible for making the decision to stop CPR. Once you begin CPR in the field, you must continue until one of the following events occurs. S. The patient starts breathing and has a pulse. T. The patient is transferred to another person who is trained in BLS, to ALS-trained personnel, or to another emergency medical responder. O. You are out of strength or too tired to continue. P. A physician who is present or providing online medical direction assumes responsibility for the patient and gives direction to discontinue CPR. Out of strength does not mean merely weary. Rather, it means that the person providing CPR is no longer physically able to perform CPR. In short, CPR should always be continued until the patient's care is transferred to a physician or higher medical authority in the field. In some cases, your medical director or a designated medical control physician may order you to stop CPR on the basis of the patient's condition. Every EMS system should have clear standing orders or protocols that provide guidelines for starting and stopping CPR. Your medical director and your system's legal advisor should agree on these protocols, which should be closely administered and reviewed by your medical director. Foreign body airway obstruction in adults. Occasionally, a large foreign body will be aspirated and block the upper airway. An airway obstruction may be caused by various things, including relaxation of the throat muscles in an unconscious patient, vomited or regurgitated stomach contents, blood, damaged tissue after an injury, dentures, or foreign bodies such as food or small objects. Large objects that cannot be removed from the airway with suction, such as loose dentures, large pieces of food, or blood clots, should be swept forward and out with your gloved index finger. Suctioning can then be used as needed to keep the airway clear of thinner secretions, such as blood, vomitus, and mucus. Recognizing foreign body airway obstruction. An airway obstruction by a foreign body in an adult usually occurs during a meal. In children, it usually occurs during mealtime or at play. Children commonly choke on peanuts, large bits of a hot dog, or small toys. If the foreign body is not removed quickly, the lungs will use up their oxygen supply and unconsciousness and death will follow. Treatment is based on the severity of airway obstruction the patient is experiencing. Mild airway obstruction. Patients with a mild, partial airway obstruction are able to exchange adequate amounts of air but still have signs of respiratory distress. Breathing may be noisy. However, the patient usually has a strong, effective cough. Leave these patients alone. Your main concern is to prevent a mild airway obstruction from becoming a severe airway obstruction. The abdominal thrust is not indicated in patients with a mild airway obstruction. For the patient with a mild airway obstruction, you should first encourage him or her to cough or to continue coughing if they are already doing so. Do not interfere with the patient's own attempts to expel the foreign body. Instead, give 100% oxygen with a non-rebreathing mask and provide prompt transport to the hospital. Closely monitor the patient and observe for signs of a severe airway obstruction, weak or absent cough, decreasing level of consciousness, cyanosis. Conscious patients. A sudden severe airway obstruction is usually easy to recognize in someone who is eating or has just finished eating. The person is suddenly unable to speak or cough, grasps his or her throat, turns cyanotic, and makes exaggerated efforts to breathe. Air is not moving into and out of the airway, or the air movement is so slight that it is not detectable. At first, the patient will be conscious and able to clearly indicate the nature of the problem. Ask the patient, "Are you choking?" The patient will usually answer by nodding yes. Alternatively, he or she may use the universal sign to indicate airway blockage. If there is a minimal amount of air movement, you may hear a high-pitched sound called stridor. This occurs when the object is not fully occluding the airway, but the small amount of air entering the lungs is not enough to sustain life, and the patient will eventually lose consciousness if the obstruction is not relieved. Unconscious patients. When you discover an unconscious patient, your first step is to determine whether he or she is breathing and has a pulse. The unconsciousness may be caused by airway obstruction, cardiac arrest, or a number of other problems. Remember that you must first clear the patient's airway, making sure it is opened and unobstructed, before checking for a pulse and addressing other problems, such as cardiac arrest. You should suspect an airway obstruction if the standard maneuvers to open the airway and ventilate the lungs are not effective. If you feel resistance to blowing into the patient's lungs or pressure builds up in your mouth, the patient probably has some type of obstruction. Removing a foreign body airway obstruction in patients older than 1 year of age. The manual maneuver recommended for removing severe airway obstructions in conscious adults and children older than 1 year of age is the abdominal thrust maneuver, the Heimlich maneuver. This technique creates an artificial cough by causing a sudden increase in intrathoracic pressure when thrusts are applied to the subdiaphragmatic region. It is a very effective method for removing a foreign body that is obstructing the airway. Conscious patients. Abdominal thrust maneuver. The abdominal thrust maneuver, also called the Heimlich maneuver, is the preferred way to dislodge a severe airway obstruction in conscious adults and children older than 1 year of age. The goal is to compress the lungs upward and force the residual air, which is always present in the lungs, to flow upwards and expel the object. In conscious patients with a severe airway obstruction, you should repeat abdominal thrusts until the foreign body is expelled or the patient becomes unconscious. Each thrust should be deliberate with the intent of relieving the obstruction. To perform abdominal thrusts on a conscious adult, use the following technique. 1. Stand behind the patient and wrap your arms around his or her abdomen. Straddle your legs outside the patient's legs. This will allow you to easily slide the patient to the ground in the event he or she becomes unconscious. 2. Make a fist with one hand. Grasp the fist with the other hand. Place the thumb side of the fist against the patient's abdomen at the midpoint between the umbilicus and the xiphoid process. 3. Press your fist into the patient's abdomen with a quick inward and upward thrust. 4. Continue abdominal thrusts until the object is expelled from the airway or the patient becomes unconscious. Chest thrusts. You can perform the abdominal thrust maneuver safely on all adults and children. However, for women in advanced stages of pregnancy and patients who are very obese, you should use chest thrusts instead. To perform chest thrusts on the conscious adult, use the following technique. 1. Stand behind the patient with your arms directly under the patient's armpits and wrap your arms around the patient's chest. 2. Make a fist with one hand. Grasp the fist with the other hand. Place the thumb side of the fist against the patient's sternum, avoiding the xiphoid process and the edges of the rib cage. 3. Press your fist into the patient's chest with backward thrusts until the object is expelled or the patient becomes unconscious. 4. If the patient becomes unconscious, you should begin CPR. Conscious patients who become unconscious. A patient with an airway obstruction may become unconscious and require additional care. Knowing that the patient had an obstruction should prompt you to open the airway and look for an obstruction before completing the additional steps of resuscitation. Use the following steps to manage the patient. 1. If you see the foreign object, remove it. If an object is not seen, CPR begins by assessing the patient's ABCs. 2. Open the patient's airway. 3. Assess for breathing. Look, listen, and feel for respirations. 4. If the patient is not breathing, attempt to give one ventilation. If the air does not go in, reposition the patient's head and attempt one more ventilation. 5. If the air still does not go in, give 30 chest compressions. 6. Look in the patient's mouth to see if you can visualize the object. If you see the object, remove it. If not, attempt to ventilate. 7. Continue steps 4 and 5 until the object is removed and airflow is established. Once you can successfully ventilate the patient, check for a pulse. If there is no pulse, begin CPR. Unconscious patients. When a victim is found unconscious, it is unlikely that you will know what caused the problem. Begin the steps of CPR by determining unresponsiveness, opening the airway, and attempting ventilation. If the first ventilation does not produce visible chest rise, reposition the head and reattempt to ventilate the patient. If both breaths fail to produce visible chest rise, perform 30 chest compressions and then open the airway and look in the mouth. If an object is visible, attempt to remove it. Never perform blind finger sweeps on any patient. Doing so may push the obstruction further into the airway. After opening the airway and looking inside the mouth, reattempt to ventilate the patient. If the air goes in, give a second breath and check for a pulse. If the air does not go in, continue the process of chest compressions, opening the airway, looking inside the mouth, and attempting to ventilate until the airway is clear or advanced life support help arrives. Foreign body airway obstruction in infants and children. Airway obstruction is a common problem in infants and children. It is usually caused by a foreign body, such as food or a toy, or by an infection, such as croup or epiglottitis, resulting in swelling and narrowing of the airway. You should try to identify the cause of the obstruction as soon as possible. In patients who have signs and symptoms of an airway infection, you should not waste time trying to dislodge a foreign body. The child needs 100% oxygen with a non-rebreathing mask and immediate transport to the emergency department. A previously healthy child who is eating or playing with small toys, or an infant who is crawling about the house and who suddenly has difficulty breathing, has probably aspirated a foreign body. As in adults, foreign bodies may cause a mild or a severe airway obstruction. With a mild airway obstruction, the patient can cough forcefully, although there may be wheezing between coughs. As long as the patient can breathe, cough, or talk, you should not interfere with his or her attempts to expel the foreign body. As with the adult, encourage the child to continue coughing. Administer 100% oxygen with a non-rebreathing mask, if tolerated, and provide transport to the emergency department. You should intervene only if signs of a severe airway obstruction develop, such as a weak, ineffective cough, cyanosis, stridor, absent air movement, or a decreasing level of consciousness. Removing a foreign body airway obstruction in a child. Conscious child. If you determine a child older than 1 year has an airway obstruction, stand or kneel behind the child and provide abdominal thrusts in the same manner as an adult, but use less force until the object is expelled or the child becomes unconscious. If the child becomes unconscious, follow the same steps as for the unconscious adult. To perform the abdominal thrust maneuver in a conscious child who is in a standing or sitting position, follow these steps. 1. Kneel on one knee behind the child and circle both of your arms around the child's body. Prepare to give abdominal thrusts by placing your fist just above the patient's umbilicus and well below the lower tip of the sternum. Place your other hand over that fist. 2. Give the child abdominal thrusts in an upward direction. Be careful to avoid applying force to the lower rib cage or sternum. 3. Repeat this standing technique until the child expels the foreign body or fully loses consciousness. 4. If the child becomes unconscious, position the child on a hard surface. Open the airway using the head-tilt-chin-lift maneuver and look inside the child's mouth. If you can see the foreign body, try to remove it. 5. Attempt rescue breathing. If the first attempt fails, reposition the head and try again. 6. If the airway remains obstructed, begin CPR. If you manage to clear the airway obstruction in an unconscious child, but he or she still has no spontaneous breathing or circulation, perform CPR. Unconscious child. An unconscious child older than 1 year who has an airway obstruction is managed in the same manner as an adult. Skill Drill 11-7 demonstrates the steps for removing a foreign body airway obstruction in an unconscious child. Skill Drill 11-7. 1. Place the child in a supine position on a firm, flat surface. 2. Open the airway using the head-tilt-chin-lift maneuver and look inside the child's mouth for the obstruction. 3. Attempt rescue breathing. If the first try is unsuccessful, reposition the child's head and try again. 4. If ventilation is still unsuccessful, begin CPR. 5. Place the heel of one hand on the lower half of the sternum between the nipples. 6. Administer 30 chest compressions. Compressions should be one-third to one-half the depth of the chest. 7. Open the airway using the head-tilt-chin-lift maneuver and look inside the child's mouth. If you see the object, remove it. 8. Repeat the process starting at step 3. Removing a foreign body airway obstruction in infants. Conscious infants. Abdominal thrusts are not recommended for conscious infants with an airway obstruction because of the risk of injury to the immature organs of the abdomen. Instead, perform back slaps and chest thrusts to try to clear a severe airway obstruction in a conscious infant as follows. 1. Hold the infant face down with the body resting on your forearm. Support the infant's jaw and face with your hand and keep the head lower than the rest of the body. 2. Deliver 5 back slaps between the shoulder blades using the heel of your hand. 3. Place your free hand behind the infant's head and back and turn the infant face up on your thigh, sandwiching the infant's body between your two hands and arms. The infant's head should remain below the level of the body. 4. Give 5 quick chest thrusts in the same location and manner as chest compressions using 2 fingers placed on the lower half of the sternum. For larger infants, or if you have small hands, you can perform this step by placing the infant in your lap and turning the infant's whole body as a unit between back slaps and chest thrusts. 5. Check the airway. If you can see the foreign body now, remove it. If not, repeat the cycle as often as necessary. 6. If the infant becomes unconscious, begin CPR, remembering to look in the airway before ventilations each time. As with the adult and child, if the infant loses consciousness, look inside the mouth. If you see the object, remove it. If not, begin CPR by opening the airway, assessing for breathing, attempting ventilations, and then delivering 30 compressions. Remember to look inside the mouth before attempting ventilations. Continue the process of compressions, looking in the mouth and attempting ventilations until the obstruction is relieved, and then assess for a pulse. if there is no pulse or the pulse is less than 60 beats per minute, begin CPR. Unconscious infants. Begin CPR, but include one extra step. Look inside the infant's airway each time before ventilating and remove the object if seen.